Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, everyone. It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Many Americans head back to work today as we kick off the new year, but the federal government is still partially shut down over a fight over the border and border security. And while many federal employees may not be going to work today, in detention centers across the country, many migrants will be. They'll be cleaning or cooking in the facilities they're housed in. The minimum pay mandated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, $1 a day. Technically, the work isn't mandatory, but detainees in multiple class action lawsuits claim that they have, in fact, been forced to work. And as the Trump administration continues to expand migrant detention, an investigation by the Daily Beast finds that the companies behind these detention centers are profiting. American taxpayers are the ones footing the bill for these facilities, to the tune of $800 million. That's according to Spencer Ackerman, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. His new investigation explores just how lucrative this business has become and who exactly benefits.
So we took a look at some of the harder to find numbers that make up this new and exploding approach to immigration detention. We reported in November that immigration detention had reached an all-time high of about 44,600 people detained on average every single day.
And these are not children, these are adults?
They include children, but adults, primarily adults. We found through crunching some numbers about the private detention aspect of immigration prisons. That's not the whole thing, but it's a substantial and rather we found alarming part of it, that that's a business in the United States that in 2018 paid, and this is a very conservative estimate for reasons we can get into, over $800 million in taxpayer money in 2018 to the corporations that perform this service.
Are American taxpayers aware of this?
By and large, it's hard to say. Those who focus on immigration probably know the contours of this. To the general public, perhaps not. And that was something that motivated us at the Daily Beast to look into this.
So who are the players in this space? Who are the folks that are making money off of locking up migrant and immigrant folks coming to this country?
It's an excellent question. And a lot of the players are some of the same corporations. There aren't that many private prison corporations at scale. So you see them, companies that one of them is called CoreCivic, used to be known as the Corrections Corporation of America, did a little bit of rebranding. Another one, the real major player in this space is called Geo Group.
Let's talk about how they make money too.
Yeah.
How is it that they make money? How do you, I mean, and these are corporations that are trading on stock exchanges. Like mm-hmm. This is, people can buy shares in CoreCivic and Geo Group. How are they making money? By setting up, by incarcerating or detaining folks?
Yes, and in a variety of different ways. So sometimes they'll take over operations that ICE and the Department of Homeland Security have already contracted out with state and local authorities. So they'll basically run operations for the detention side of immigration detention in county prisons, for instance. Other times, they'll sort of purpose build a facility just for immigration detention. So that's one of the ways that we found that some of the numbers in terms of both where immigration detention takes place for the private prisons corporations, as well as the scale of it, can get sometimes hidden because the Department of Homeland Security will kind of reveal some aspects of these numbers, but not really the total of them.
Now, we know that in prison, inmates are generally are forced to work for pennies on the dollar. Is the same happening in these detention facilities? Are migrants being forced to work for pennies on the dollar?
So formally, no. Formally, the Department of Homeland Security and ICE say that all prison labor and immigration detention is supposed to be voluntary, that you can't compel someone to work. People I talk to, including a young woman who's been in immigration detention for 2 years, says that in practice, not really so much that she acknowledges that, you know, no guard is forcing her to sweep a corridor or to make someone's food. But the reality of immigration detention is that it's an anxious circumstance. There's very little certainty except for the very real and very heavy likelihood that tomorrow you're still going to be locked up like you are today. And that often leads people to break up the monotony of the day and give themselves something to take their minds off of the circumstances that they're in, to jobs as minimally compensated as a dollar a day. This woman in particular that we talk about in the piece quite a bit, for the last, I believe, like 5 months, every day she's elected to perform kitchen functions that happen at the break of dawn or before. So she'll cook food for other detainees, she'll serve it, she'll clean up, and that typically happens between 2 and 8 in the morning. That pays $3 a day, which is more than the $1 required minimal compensation at a lot of these immigration detention facilities.
But there are lawsuits that are alleging that some of folks have been forced to do work. Is that right?
Several. The tens of thousands of people have sued GEO Group and CoreCivic. Sometimes there have been state's attorney general lawsuits that say that this work fundamentally, because of the fact that it occurs in an incarceration setting, even though that's not supposed to be how immigration detention formally is, nevertheless, is fundamentally coercive. That essentially out of that brings parallels from a lot of immigration activists and attorneys to slave labor in uncomfortable ways that don't often get discussed when we talk about immigration.
What kinds of profits are we talking about here that these companies are making? Can you give us a dollar amount somewhere?
Well, for instance, GEO Group, which runs one of the facilities that incarcerate and employ one of the women who's central to the story that we told, they expect to make something like $2.2 billion over the last fiscal year.
Are the folks who have been detained, are these migrants also being asked to pay for things like personal hygiene items or food?
Indeed, you find that the money that they make in these prisons goes back into their commissary. So in effect, they're paying the people who both employ them and lock them up.
You said commissary, and I keep thinking we're talking about people who have been detained and not incarcerated. Folks aren't even citizens of the United States. I mean, what recourse do they have in this environment?
A minimal recourse, basically. They can take it up with their attorneys when they're allowed to see them. One attorney we profile in the piece, she and six colleagues out in Aurora, Colorado, provide free legal counsel to 1,000 people. So we're not really talking about, in practice, people who are set up to provide much in the way of recourse. But, you know, we mentioned there are class action suits that have been filed on behalf of people who are working in this setting. And it's important to remember here, to take a bit of a step back, that immigration detention by law is not supposed to be punitive. This is not supposed to be something that people have been punished for, that it's not something that the violation that they're accused of committing is being redressed through the detention. The detention is supposed to be, again, in theory, a mechanism to compel people to go to their immigration hearings. In a lot of cases, these are people who are trying to apply for asylum. They want these hearings in the first place. They're incentivized in that way to already, you know, attend them, to participate in the proceedings. In many cases, these are people who will have to, you know, learn in a foreign language a different country's immigration law, as complex as that is, to represent their own interests here, because of the realities of how difficult it is in practice to provide for an actual legal defense. It's also important to keep in mind the Trump administration, in its budget submissions to Congress, expects the number of people that it locks up for immigration reasons to keep on rising. So, for instance, in the budget that it had submitted for, you know, whether this actually comes to pass or not, who knows, but for February 19th, 2019, it anticipates detaining about 52,000 people. That's already up from the all-time high that we're seeing right now of over 44,000 people. And that 44,000 people is substantially up from what ICE was budgetarily allowed to detain in 2018 already. So the budget submissions are very likely not the real numbers that are going in here, that it's going to be substantially more people that are going to be locked up.
Now, are there connections between the current administration, the Trump administration, and the private prison industry?
Quite so. The major corporations in the private prisons industry for both general federal incarceration and for immigration detention, GEO Group and CoreCivic, gave tremendous amounts of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to Trump's campaign and to his inauguration. We've seen people who used to run important aspects of ICE and the Department of Homeland Security take prestigious jobs and lucrative jobs at these corporations. So there really does seem to be a revolving door happening, and in particular that the companies saw that betting on the Trump administration with its hardline approach to immigration, with its carceral approach to immigration, and with its growing immigration numbers represented a good investment on their part. They would make money off this policy.
I'm wondering also how you see this at a time when the Trump administration, well, Democrats and Republicans more broadly, have come to a consensus on criminal justice reform for American citizens. Does this fall into that category at all, or are you seeing any bipartisan agreements to mitigate detention, not just criminal justice in the United States?
Well, immigration detention is not supposed to occur in the context of the criminal justice system at all. Being in the United States, quote unquote, illegally is a misdemeanor civil violation. It's not a criminal offense. Similarly, as we mentioned, incarceration for immigration reasons isn't supposed to be punitive. These are supposed to be apples and oranges. In reality, we are seeing the increased carceral approach to immigration sort of swallowing the system.
Spencer Ackerman is a senior national security correspondent for The Daily Beast. Spencer, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks very much for having me to talk about it.
We reached out to CoreCivic and GEO Group for comment on this investigation, and here's what CoreCivic told us. Quote, "We do not enforce immigration laws or policies or have any say whatsoever in an individual's deportation or release. CoreCivic does not know the circumstances of individuals when they are placed in a facility, and our responsibility is to care for each person respectfully and humanely while they receive the legal due process to which they are entitled." Their full statement can be found at thetakeaway.org. We have not heard back from GEO Group. Middle-aged and worried about staying employed? Well, a new analysis of older American workers from ProPublica and the Urban Institute says working after 50 is, in fact, more turbulent than many of us thought.
After age 50, about half of workers are separated involuntarily from their job, either actually laid off, the business closed, or they were strongly encouraged to leave. They ended up retiring unexpectedly. The work conditions deteriorated so much that the job was no longer viable for them.
That's Richard Johnson, an Urban Institute economist and scholar of the older labor force. He worked on the analysis recently published with ProPublica. Last week, I chimed in and tweeted about the need for news organizations to hire people from all ages, not just younger workers. And it's no secret that getting and keeping a job at an older age can be a daunting task. Some of you told me that your field seemed to prize younger employees to the detriment of those with more experience. And we heard from many of our listeners who called us to say, yes, that's what happened to me.
This is Ron. I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas.
This is Sarah from Jeffersonville, Indiana.
My name is Alexander. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas.
Hello, this is Eric in Philadelphia. I was laid off from a long-time job about 2.5 years ago. I had only modest savings since it was not a high-paying job, and I haven't found regular employment so far since then. So what savings I have been used up, so I'm just getting by from day to day at present.
I was forced out of a job. I hadn't been there long, but it is the job that I wanted, and I was forced out of it. Still searching for a similar job while keeping myself occupied with Uber.
My mother, who's turning 60 this year, has been a nurse for over 30 years, working well over 12-hour shifts at a time and suffering from chronic illness. My mother is now in fear of losing her job, which she so dearly loves and enjoys, as well as the roof over her head.
Downsized 7.5 years ago, haven't worked a day since.
I asked Richard Johnson of the Urban Institute to take us through the data and explain what's actually legal when it comes to ageism in the workplace.
What we know is that age discrimination is illegal, and yet it's very difficult to prove. And that's really the problem. And in fact, in 2009, the Supreme Court made it harder to prove because the Supreme Court said about 10 years ago that you can only prove discrimination if you can show that age is the only cause for you being laid off, for you not being hired, for your wages being cut. And that's a really difficult bar to meet. And so, you know, it's just something that employers can always point to some other reason. Well, that's really not why this person was laid off. There are other factors at play. And so we see that there are a lot of claims against age discrimination. And the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, part of the federal government that enforces these age discrimination laws, you know, makes an effort, but it's just really tough.
So let's talk a little bit about how what we're seeing today compares to past workforce trends. Have older workers, i.e. workers over 40, always had to be this worried about their job security? Or is this something that we're seeing increasingly across the board?
Yeah, I mean, there really does seem to be a trend suggesting that things are getting worse. You know, the one thing we noticed during the Great Recession was that there was a big spike in unemployment rates for people 65 and older. We didn't see that back in the early 80s when employment also spiked. Overall employment rates increased in the early 1980s and 1983 when we had a big recession, but not for older workers. So this is something new. And in fact, when we looked at people over time in the study we did, comparing responses in 1998 and 2014, we found that the share of workers, recent retirees who said that they had been forced or partly forced into retirement, increased by 22%, from 33% to 55%. So a really big increase in the share of workers who say, you know, I'm really not quite ready to retire, and yet I can't find work.
And I'm wondering also whether it's so hard to prove these cases because they are looking for intent to discriminate. Is that part of the issue here in terms of being able to prove age discrimination?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So intent is an important part of it. And that's something that's different from race discrimination and let's say sex discrimination in employment. You really have to show intent. And as I said earlier, that's so hard to prove.
Wondering why it's so hard, because the research that you have shows that this is actually a problem. We've seen other research from ProPublica that also shows, for example, I'm thinking of an IBM report that came out that showed systemic pushouts of older employees. So with all of this data, why is it still so difficult?
One thing we've found is that class action suits are harder to organize now. Employers can have these employment agreements, which workers aren't even aware of, which say you can't be part of a class action suit. To show intent, you really need to show that this is a broad-based problem. That's not just a one-off. It's not just this one person who is being injured. And to get those people together and is really hard. In fact, the bigger problem, too, is it's not just being laid off. It's also being hired. And it's very difficult to prove that the employer is not hiring you because of your age, because you don't know who else is being interviewed, who else is being hired. You know, at least when you're being laid off, you can look at the other people in the firm who lost their jobs and say, gee, you know, they're all over 50. They're all over 60. And certainly, the reporting that my colleague Peter Goslin at ProPublica did finds that, you know, a lot of the cases that he looked at, many people were saying that everyone who was laid off at their firm with them were older folks.
I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit more of an example of how this plays out in real life, because part of the research was looking at individual stories. Is that right?
That's right. So, you know, we both looked at nationally representative household survey data, which looked at thousands of people to get sort of overall trends, overall numbers, really how widespread is this. But then we dug into individual stories. And you know, one of the more compelling cases was a man by the name of Tom Steckel, who is now the director of employee benefits for South Dakota. He's 62 years old. He's had this job for a few years now, but he was originally laid off at age 51. He had been with a shipping company for 27 years. He had worked his way up. He was in human resources. He then had three other jobs, laid off from each of those. His initial layoff, he was out of work for 8 months. He finally found this job in South Dakota. The problem is he lives in Wisconsin, so he has a 700-mile drive, which he does once a month. You know, he's not able to live with his family as a result, and he's only making 60% of what he made when he was age 51. So, you know, there are countless stories like this of people who were working toward retirement. They had a secure job. They thought they could hold it until they were ready to retire, and then the rug was pulled out from underneath them, you know, in their 50s when they were unexpectedly laid off.
And Richard, what's something that we can do to make the workplace better for older workers at this point?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is just trying to convince employers of the value that older workers have, and that's something that groups like AARP have been working on for years. You know, another thing is maybe there's some public policy changes we can make. Certainly stronger enforcement of age discrimination laws, but also changing the law to make it easier to prove age discrimination and to hold employers accountable. I think that's important. We could also think about maybe some better workforce development programs. So training programs, maybe specifically geared to older workers. And the federal government could have just help older workers find jobs. You know, the job search has changed so much over the past 20 years. Older people who haven't searched for jobs for 20, 30 years could have been a bit of a disadvantage in terms of finding a new job because the process has changed. So more training in terms of that could certainly help older folks.
Richard Johnson is an economist with the Urban Institute. Richard, thanks so much for your time and for your work.
Thank you very much.
Hey, everyone. It's The Takeaway. While people around the world were ringing in the new year Monday night, another historic event was unfolding about 4 billion miles from Earth. NASA's New Horizons space probe flew past a tiny rock in space, and that rock, called MU69, is the farthest object in the solar system that humankind has ever explored. The probe will be sending back data and high-resolution photos of MU69. And it's a significant moment for space exploration, and Emily Rice is here to tell us all about it. She's a professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center, and a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. Emily, I can't think of anyone better to help us understand what this is all about. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is MU69? It's a little rock, and we're all excited about it? Why?
Yeah, well, we're about to find out what it is. That's one of the great big mysteries, is that this object, the full official name right now is 2014 MU69, because it was only discovered in 2014. So it's one of these Kuiper Belt objects that are out there at kind of towards the outer edge of the solar system. And there's a lot of unanswered questions about this part of the solar system. And so this object happened to be on the way of New Horizons, basically. Only slight trajectory shifts could get us really, really close to it. And so it was picked to be the target for the extended mission, and it's had a successful flyby.
Now, I'm no astrophysicist, obviously, but aren't there lots of rocks flying around at that in space? Like, why is this one so special?
This one's so special just because of where it was, basically. There are lots of rocks flying around out in space, but still the vast majority of space is really, really empty. Even the Kuiper Belt is much more massive than the asteroid belt, which people might be more familiar with. There's a lot more objects in the Kuiper Belt, but still huge amounts of empty space in between them.
So what kind of data was the New Horizons satellite collecting? Like, what were they looking for, and why did they get so excited when they saw MU69?
There's several instruments on the New Horizons spacecraft that do imaging and imaging spectroscopy. So the spectroscopy—
That sounds complicated.
Yeah,
okay.
It does, but it's not. It's like spectra. It's like a rainbow, basically. A rainbow at different wavelengths of light. And so the images is what really hits us. That's when we can see new images of outer solar system objects. We go from a fuzzy blob to a new world, like we did when New Horizons passed Pluto and the Charon system several years ago, and we have these new textbook images. You know, everything had to be rewritten. It was beautiful. And now we're going to get the same thing, but for a much, much smaller object. So the images by themselves are going to be astounding, and those will give us a much better idea of the shape of the object, actually whether it might be two objects. Right now we think it's kind of like a peanut shape. And that peanut could actually be disconnected, or it could be a contact binary. We'll find out when the higher resolution data comes in. But the spectroscopy, the kind of more detailed observations, are going to tell us a little bit more about the composition of the surface of the object.
And what will that tell us if we know what it's made out of? What does that tell you guys?
Tell us about the formation of the object, as well as the formation of the entire solar system, because we really do think this object is a relic of the formation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago.
Like when everything went bang?
when the solar system went bang, kind of. When the dust settled in the solar system.
So is this one of those little pieces of dust that maybe potentially was there 4 billion years ago?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Now that makes it interesting.
Yeah.
Now I'm intrigued. Okay, so how long before we get to see images, Emily?
In the next couple of days, some high resolution data will come in. It's actually going to be public right away, a lot of the data, and then kind of once a week, more images will be released. It's still not going to be, you know, I think sometimes with the Hubble Space Telescope, we get spoiled with images. This one, at best, we might get about 200 pixels across.
What about, there was a little bit of a controversy, too, about the name. Tell us a little bit about that. What's going on there?
MU69 does have a nickname right now. The nickname that was chosen by the mission from 30-some-odd suggestions before the flyby happened, but after it was kind of planned and after the target was discovered and chosen, is Ultima Thule, or Ultima Thule. And that's it's an ancient term that going back into Greco-Roman mythology, I believe, that means kind of the ultimate edge of the world. It was previously used to talk about Greenland and Iceland and things like that. But there's been some controversy because we realized, you know, during all the hype of this flyby that Ultima Thule has also been used by Nazis before the 1930s, but as the Aryan homeland. And a woman wrote an article in Newsweek about it in even March of this year, but kind of, you know, it kind of flew under the radar for a little while. And so some people are saying, well, you know, we really can do better than this. Like, even though it's a temporary nickname, especially in today's day and age, like, you know, science is not completely divorced from politics and everything else that's going on. And so we should really take these into account, even when we're just picking a temporary nickname.
Yeah, sounds like a not so great choice so far, but we shall see what the scientific community comes up with next.
It will get an official name probably before the end of 2019 from the International Astronomical Union.
So, Emily, as we enter the new year, what besides this are we excited about when it comes to space exploration?
2019 might be the year of the moon, I think. Yeah, it's kind of exciting because it's the 50th anniversary of humans landing on the moon. But there's also, you know, we kind of humans haven't gone back, which is really disappointing to me. I was born after the Apollo era. And so I would love to look at the moon and see people walking on it. But really, the next best thing is to explore previously unexplored regions of the moon. So we've imaged it. There's been orbiters. But there's a bunch of landers that are going to go onto the moon in the next year by the Chinese Space Agency, as well as a sample return mission that they're doing. And by the Indian Space Agency. Both have lunar landing missions planned this year, which is really exciting because it includes especially the far side of the moon as well as the south pole of the moon. So places that we haven't really explored too much in detail.
I was just going to say something about the dark side of the moon, but I'll save that.
Yeah.
Emily Rice is a professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center, and a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. Emily, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This month marks 46 years since the U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion through the landmark case Roe v. Wade. Now, just about 2 years into his presidency, Donald Trump has appointed 2 Supreme Court judges and a number of conservative appellate judges, raising concerns among abortion rights activists about the future of the law. There are currently more than a dozen abortion cases before federal appeals courts.
The reality is that since the Trump-Pence administration took office, there's been a constant onslaught from the federal level against reproductive rights.
Andrea Miller is the president of the National Institute for Reproductive Health, and she says these restrictions to abortion aren't new.
We have had a record number of states that over, frankly, the last 4.5 decades have been passing law after law after law against abortion. In fact, your listeners might be shocked to know that since 1973, there have been more than 1,100 laws specifically against abortion passed at the state level. So you have a record number of states now, and they sort of exacerbated that over the last couple of years, that make it more and more difficult, if not impossible, for many women to access abortion, much less feel that they have the right any longer. And that clearly is very troubling, especially given that we have an increasingly hostile federal judiciary that just in the last past 2 years, including at the Supreme Court level, the Trump-Pence administration has had the opportunity to try to pack the courts against reproductive freedom. But I don't want people to feel completely disheartened, because 2018 was remarkable in 2 other important ways. The first is that we saw a record number of proactive laws, 100 proactive laws that were enacted at the state level to protect and expand reproductive rights and access to reproductive health care, including abortion. And the midterm elections were really, I believe, a turning point. We saw a record number of candidates who ran and won on advancing reproductive freedom, including a very bold and proactive stance on abortion access. And voters made this a priority in race after race after race. So we've had a lot of decline in the last couple of years, and yet there is tremendous momentum building across the country, and that is really where I think the future lies.
Let's talk a little bit about which states have actually restricted access to abortion and what those abortion restrictions look like.
So over the last 4.5 decades, the attacks against abortion access have come from every corner, and now we have about half the states, if not more, considered hostile to reproductive freedom. And what that means is that they have multiple restrictions on the books. So if you look in states like Arkansas or South Dakota or North Dakota, if you are a woman seeking an abortion there, you probably have to delay. You have to get state scripted information. You may have to come back to a clinic 2, if not 3 times. You may be in a state that has only one clinic, which means traveling hundreds of miles, finding childcare, or being able to leave your job for a day or multiple days. You need to have transportation. Your insurance, whether you have private insurance, government-sponsored insurance, whether you are low-income and eligible for Medicaid, your insurance will not cover it. And if you are young, you probably have to involve your parents regardless of whether that is going to be safe and okay for you. So there's a huge disparate impact, as you can imagine, on those who are most marginalized and with least access to care, women of color, low-income women, young women, women living in rural areas. And most recently, we're seeing our sort of usual cast of characters of states, your Louisianas, your Mississippis, your Kentuckys, passing more and more restrictive laws, in fact, trying to ban abortion outright earlier and earlier in pregnancy. And they're being, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, joined by some relative newcomers like the Iowas and Ohios of the world. Again, what they are trying to do, just to be clear, is that they are trying to attack at the fundamental level not only the right and legality as well as the accessibility of abortion for anyone within their borders, but they really all have the same goal of hopefully creating a scenario where an increasingly hostile Supreme Court will have a new vehicle through lawsuits that will come their way to further eviscerate, if not outright overturn, Roe versus Wade. And so their goal is twofold, which is to deny those in their own states access and the ability to exercise their rights, and ultimately to try to eliminate that right at the federal level across the country.
You mentioned Ohio, and I'm wondering, which states are you looking at? There's a bunch of abortion cases out in different courts in different states right now. Are there any cases that you say we should be paying very close attention to that could potentially signal which way this fight is going to go?
So I try not to make predictions on this, but I will say the ones to watch are the ones that really do try to ban abortion earlier and earlier, whether that's through bans on particular methods of abortion and therefore putting the government in the position of determining, rather than healthcare providers, what is going to be the kind of care that can be provided, or trying to do so earlier and earlier in pregnancy. Those are the ones that really strike at the heart of Roe versus Wade, because what they do is that they say that a state can interfere, the government can interfere and prohibit a woman from getting abortions at any point. So I think any of these cases could present the opportunity, but it's hard to say which one will ultimately be the one that will create the conditions for an even further eroded Roe.
Roe v. Wade has been around for 46 years. Is there something unique that you see in this moment right now?
What I think is unique in this moment is that we have such a clear indication of how much harm and how much damage is being done by these restrictive laws. I believe that one of the reasons we are seeing such hostile legislation being passed and such a rush to pack the federal judiciary to try to eliminate reproductive freedom is that I believe that those who would like to and who've made it their mission to ultimately eliminate the ability of women to make their own decisions for what's best for their bodies, for their lives, for their futures, for their families, that they are realizing that time is not on their side. History is not on their side. The fact is that we have more support for Roe versus Wade, more support for not just legal abortion, but for accessible, affordable, available in your community that includes abortion than at any other time in the history of this country, including at any other time since Roe versus Wade.
Andrea Miller is the president of the National Institute for Reproductive Health. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.